Good day, everybody, and welcome to this edition of Blood Club, where you're supposed to talk about Blood Club, not keep it a secret. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Danielle Brander from Duke University, and we're going to talk about chronic lymphocytic leukemia, a disease that, when I think back to fellowship, has been completely turned upside down by the therapeutics that now are becoming standard of care, and chemotherapy is in the rearview mirror. So thank you, Dr. Brander, for joining us today. So I was alluding to CLL has been turned upside down, but I want to kind of rewind all the way back to kind of thinking about CLL as a disease that's often found incidentally, whether or not you're going for your Medicare physical, annual physical, or just showing up for insurance physicals. You know, can you educate me on, has anything changed in regards to kind of this spectrum of this disease around monoclonal B-cell lymphocytosis, to all the way to where you would call it CLL over the last decade?
Great point. I think certainly still there are a lot of patients that fortunately are overall feeling well. This is found incidentally on a physical, or, you know, potentially they're ill with another issue. And increasingly, because the diagnostic tools, for example, flow cytometry, are more accessible, often other, you know, physicians, primary care, or even urgent care, other specialists may send flow on the blood when they notice a relative lymphocytosis. And I think in general, we're seeing that more, meaning patients may be very early in their disease course or not even have burden enough to call it CLL. In other words, by counts, absence of symptoms, absence of cytopenias or lymph nodes, they have a small monoclonal population found, and we call that MBL. Regardless, I think one of the things that hasn't changed over the years, as you mentioned, is that we still, for the most part, have most of patients, whether MBL, of course, or CLL, that don't require therapeutic interventions, don't require treatment at the time of diagnosis. Some of those patients, of course, will go years and decades and never require it. Some will require it over time, for example, but certainly if diagnosed very early or as an MBL, then of course their time to possible treatment may be even longer. So while early intervention from past trials hasn't shown a benefit in survival, meaning treatment before treatment indications are met, fortunately, people keep asking these questions in trials. And so there's been German trials looking at ibrutinib that so far hasn't shown as a early intervention. And then there's a large cooperative group study looking at venetoclax and obinutuzumab called the EVOLVE study for early intervention high-risk patients.
So what would be that high-risk population? Because I think there's been a lot of evolution. I mean, the RAI criteria now is, I think, older than I am. You know, so are you still using that, or are you using different tools to kind of assess risk in newly diagnosed CLL?
Yeah, great question. To your point is, rather than, you know, anchoring on any one system, because it's so hard to integrate multiple markers, I think then we get marker overload and then we just don't want to check any of them. But the CLL IPI score is a very helpful tool. It was developed a couple years ago, or published a couple years ago, I should say, back in about 2016. And while that tool, which integrates a couple markers I'll mention and factors, underestimates overall survival because it came out in 2016. And to your point, before we had a lot of these therapeutics, it is quite helpful in counseling patients of what to expect in terms of time to treatment 2 and 5 years after diagnosis. So I often will use the integrated CLL IPI to frame conversations because, of course, patients understandably not just want to know whether they need treatment or not, but how likely. And that CLL IPI does factor in RAI stage. So in that way, yes, absolutely. But as you've mentioned, most patients are early RAI stage. And so for most of them, that factor alone at the time of diagnosis, they're unlikely to fall in the high risk. But it also integrates high risk cytogenetic features, for example, deletion of 17p or TP53, IGHV mutation status, where unmutated is unfavorable, and age. And it's weighted, meaning each factor has different points if it's present. And then that gives you a score as low, intermediate, high, or very high risk.
Are you having that discussion with your CLL patients at the time of diagnosis? Do they want to get those prognostic variables, or do you sometimes have a discussion about waiting for those until you're starting to see that maybe they need to have their CLL treated? And as you alluded to, that can be many years.
You know, most of the tests, as I mentioned, are your exam, their age. They disclose, of course. But the main two tests, the FISH CLL panel and the IGHV, I do send around the time of diagnosis and not wait. I mean, one, for most institutions, the CLL FISH panel includes the translocation 1114 rule out mantle cell lymphoma. So you're going to want to be checking that anyway. And the IGHV now is pretty much available at most places. But for many patients, not just knowing what to expect with treatment, but for example, something else comes up, you know, they have a new symptom or labs change a little bit. And if you know they're low risk, that may inform your management of wanting to wait and see, dig, you know, for other causes, for example, versus if they're high risk or bordering treatment, how frequently you're going to see them. So I find that helpful. And then, as I mentioned, for things like clinical trials, and we're going to talk about early intervention or introduce that opportunity, you know, I think patients deserve to know their likelihood of needing treatment, even if they didn't participate. So
that's a great point. And, yeah. You know, so let's kind of fast forward. You have that risk stratification and they do go on active surveillance for several years, but now you're seeing kind of evolution of their disease. We were always taught not to pay attention necessarily to the lymphocyte count or the ALC. Some of us pay attention to doubling time, but then it often becomes hard to find that. We have no fancy graphs in our EMR that help and assist from that standpoint. But as you're approaching kind of your first treatment kind of crossroads with your patients, are you reassessing their FISH? I know the IGH mutated unmutation status won't change, but are you looking for evolution of that clone or that high-risk clone that may have been, you know, kind of a minority, now is a creeping up into the majority in CLL?
Absolutely. So if something is changing in their disease tempo or before treatment, if it's been a couple years, I will repeat the FISH. Now with novel therapies, of course, for the most part, we're not choosing between chemo or not and the markers. But if patients have a TP53 or 17P, that may factor into treatment selection. So if they had a smaller clone and now that's become dominant, you'll want to know that. But to your point, the other markers that I don't necessarily check at diagnosis if patients don't look like they're needing treatment right away, but I do prior to therapy, in addition to repeating the FISH, is full karyotype analysis, because complex karyotype is important to know. And then TP53 mutation as a separate. I often don't check that necessarily at diagnosis, since, you know, most patients will also have a 17p deletion, but certainly there are a portion of patients that have TP53 mutation without 17p.
This is absolutely excellent practical advice here that I think that you're giving us, because a lot of our patients, we may see 20 of them, and, you know, over time, five of them will need, you know, get to that treatment threshold, where a minority will actually probably live, you know, almost their full lifespan, you know, without needing treatment for their CLL. So let's talk about that patient population that does need frontline therapy. How are you choosing wisely? And let's stay out of the clinical trial realm. We know that that's a great answer, and a lot of clinical trials have informed, you know, kind of this, but it's often brought a little bit of chaos and confusion to the frontline CLL space.
To your point, regardless, especially if these are longitudinal patients, you've already kind of started having the discussion and know whether they have opportunity to consider trials. But right now for frontline therapy for patients with CLL, it is a longer discussion, which is a good thing, because we have a couple options that we don't yet really have head-to-head results to say one path is better than the other. Meaning continuous BTK inhibitors, of course, an oral therapy, or venetoclax-based fixed duration treatment, which is obinutuzumab. And taking that conversation and individualizing it, I generally say I think of three main realms that I talk to patients about and choosing the best path for them. One are patient-specific factors, meaning what are their comorbidities, what other medications are they on? Not necessarily for drug-drug interactions, but renal function, for example, and tumor lysis risk might not go so well together. BTK inhibitors, and concern a cardiovascular or bleeding risk, though not a contraindication with DOACs or oral anticoagulants, just something for patients to know. So there's that around the patient-specific factors. There are the disease-specific factors. We've talked a lot about 17P or TP53. While not absolutely necessary, for the most part, I tend to favor continuous suppression of that clone with the continuous BTK inhibitor. So that may be one testing route disease factor that takes you in that direction. Other disease factors are every CLL patient is slightly different in the way their disease is distributed. Is it mostly bulky lymph nodes? Is it heavily marrow-based? And how fast do you need a response? You know, obinutuzumab venetoclax can often clear out the marrow faster. If they have very bulky lymph nodes, you might lean to a BTK. And then last is the regimen specific. And of course, amongst all of this, you know, patient preference is part of it. But I think that really comes into play with the regimens too. They're very different. And the feasibility and patient goals obviously are important. Obinutuzumab and ven, some patients will be able to commit to the more intensive IV treatments, the tumor lysis ramp up, because they really want fixed duration. Other patients, it's just not feasible to come for all the testing, or they don't mind being on a continuous therapy without having to do IV or some of the other risks like neutropenia. So is why we try to start these discussions, and often before they obviously absolutely therapy, we have an opportunity to talk about it and know what direction they're going.
Yeah, I think when I'm having these discussions, you know, I look into my calendar or my clinic schedule and I mark a 40-minute slot, and then Big Brother wants to know why I'm seeing a return over 40 minutes, you know, because these can be long out, as you said, iterative discussions over time. One of the last questions that I have before we conclude here is chemotherapy dead? You know, we see still bendamustine, you know, in the armamentarium of some, you know, physicians for CLL. You know, is there an appropriate time, in your opinion, where bendamustine would be an appropriate frontline therapy for CLL?
The short answer, based on randomized trial data of survival, is no. The practical reality is, listen, I'm not in the room with the physician patient relationship or the hospital for that matter. And I mention that because these novel therapies are great, but they're oral. They take time to receive. Patients might show up inpatient. You have to come up with a way to treat and stabilize that patient. So that's kind of the first part of the answer, which is first and foremost, we're always going to want to do safe and best for our patients. The second just point I would say is feasibility of, you know, cost and approval take time. And I think this podcast, of course, is focused more on U.S. therapy, but this is a global problem. And, you know, again, everything we've talked about today, the testing, et cetera, is not universally available or feasible. And then lastly, I will just say, it's just the reality of we need to be cognizant of looking at the data and saying, which of these barriers can we help? You know, bendamustine very much across this country is definitely a top regimen being used. And maybe in some of those cases, there could have been other possibilities, and we need to still look in that direction.
I 100% agree. When I delve into Medicare Part D versus Part B, it's very hard to get that kind of data, you know, at an individual level, and you see it globally from that standpoint. That's great advice, you know, in the onset here of when CLL needs to be treated. So I want to thank Dr. Brander today for joining us and talking about kind of in her practice, how she wades through what is, you know, and can be a chaotic and difficult decision on, you know, when to pull these drugs off the shelf in a disease which we have completely revolutionized its therapy. And I think overall its outcome. Thank you again for coming to Blood Club, and I hope to see you and talk about it and you join us for our next podcast. Have a great day.